The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Raise Children You Can Be Proud Of, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Shlomo Ben Horav Moshe, Udavora Liza Bas Reb Moshe Aaron, Dr. and Mrs. Solomon and Louisa Nussbaum.
For a parent, the most precious and well-received blessing that one could probably receive is the blessing, may you have much nachas from your children. Nachas is defined in this context as a profound sense of satisfaction and pride. For most parents in general, and Jewish parents in particular, an inordinate amount of our conversations, dreams, and anxieties center around issues of family and children. The feelings of hurt and frustration that parents experience when, despite all the time, effort, and emotional energy that went into raising their child, that child does not become this expected source of nachas, was probably best described by the subject of a recent article in the Wall Street Journal. Paraphrasing a quote attributed to the late Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, she said, "If you mess up raising your kids, nothing much else you do in life matters." But for many, nachas, satisfaction from children, is an elusive goal. Even when other goals in child rearing are met, the child enrolls in a prestigious school of higher learning, graduates with the highest honors, is employed in a position that offers great job satisfaction as well as financial remuneration, marries into a distinguished family, there's still no guarantee of true nachas. Perhaps the following joke would best illustrate this point. Two old friends who hadn't seen each other in years happened to bump into one another. After speaking about old times, one of them said to the other, "You know, I forgot to tell you, I get a mazel tov." "What happened?" the friend asks. "My daughter is getting married this Sunday." "Oh, mazel tov! To whom?" "You won't know him personally." "What does he do?" "He's a neurosurgeon. In fact, he's the head of the Department of Neurosurgery, one of the country's leading teaching hospitals." "Wow. Wow, really, mazel tov. You know, this is not her first marriage. Her last husband was a senior partner, one of the largest law firms in the state." "Oh, gosh. And that wasn't her first marriage, though." Her first husband was a psychiatrist. "In fact, I understand that the books that he wrote some years ago in this particular subspecialty are still classics in the field." "Kenayin hara," was the mixed cry of jealousy and joy that blurted from his astonished friend. "Oh, so much nachas from one child." Despite all the so-called success that this man's daughter had achieved, we would all admit that something is definitely wrong. It would seem that more goes into achieving nachas from children than just the attainment of status and financial security. Perhaps this could be best be explained with the findings of a recent survey that was conducted by the host of a radio talk show. He asked his listeners to present the following question to their children. "What do you think," this would be the question, "I most want you to be," or if the child has left home, "what do you think I most wanted you to be?" "Happy," 1, 2, "smart," 3, "successful," or 4, "good." Many parents called to tell the host of the program how surprised and saddened they were to learn that their child placed good low on the list. This was not necessarily an indictment of the personal positions on the issues of honesty, integrity, and care for other people's feelings and their scheme in the overall picture of life. What it is, though, is an illustration how we often fail to communicate these standards to our children. And in the final analysis, if you produced a child with a poor moral and spiritual vision, no matter what the material successes he or she achieves, this child will in all probability become a constant source of concern and pain, affecting not only him or her and the immediate family, but many yet to be born generations in the future. The secret of producing children that you can be proud of and instilling a moral and spiritual sense into your children is the subject of tonight's lecture. We've divided this lecture into 8 sections. The first letter of the title of each section spelling out the mnemonic acronym CHILDREN. And I hope all of you have a handout, and if you don't, why don't you come to the front here. The first area I'd like to discuss starts with the C of children, and it means goes for coach. One of the great responsibilities that's placed on every parent is to train their children. According to the Talmud, this is the mitzvah of chinuch, of training. But training is not merely lecturing or mouthing platitudes. And it probably is closer to the idea of coaching. I don't know if you've ever seen or participated in coaching a child in a little league team. It isn't enough you tell them how to hold the bat. If he's not holding it, you go over and put the hands in the right position. And if the swing isn't correct, you go and demonstrate to the child and make sure that the child corrects his swing. A similar parallel would be to a music teacher, someone who teaches piano or violin. Again, it's not merely teaching, but showing, making sure the child has it right. The first quote that we have from the Talmud is from the Tractate Sukkah. I'd like to go over just some of the subjects here to give you a sense of what this mitzvah of chinuch, the requirement of training, entails. And it starts off with some areas we're familiar with. We just had the holiday of Sukkot. A minor knows how to shake the lulav, is subject to the obligation of lulav. You have to make sure your child has a lulav. He has to know how to shake it. It isn't a 2-year-old, it isn't a 4-year-old. But if he knows how to use it, at least he has a dexterity, then you should start training him. It goes on to wrapping oneself in a talus, tefillin, which we are accustomed as we do it prior to the bar mitzvah. What's interesting, though, is the end of this paragraph that deals with teaching your child Torah. It says, as soon as he can speak, you start. You make sure that his first words are all part of the spirit that you want to instill in the child. And it's many, many households, including our own, as soon as they began to speak, you teach them the sentence which we just read in Simchas Torah. Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Mayrosha kihilas Yaakov. The Moses commanded us a law, an inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. The child does not know what this means, but it becomes part of the child, second nature. And once the child has the intelligence and the learning to appreciate what it is, it's not foreign. It's something that's already familiar to me. The same is with the Shema. These, of course, are only examples. But the idea is that you start as soon as the child is able to do. Because you want to make sure that those values that you want to instill in the child become second nature. And you also have to make sure that you don't undermine your efforts. To give you a for instance, I was listening to a lecture. An educator gave the following example about how to teach truth. How do you instill truth in children? And you can imagine the parents that are so involved in this, in truth teaching, and they give their child special classes about the importance of truth, in seminars, have discussions, see a film. You've done all this for your child. And then you're taking your child to an exhibit. Your child is 7 years old. The sign reads, six and under, free. And you whisper, tell him you're six. You've killed everything. You can spout all these platitudes. You can give all these lectures. But it has to be consistent. And they have to see it in real life. And that's what really coaching is all about. It isn't just book learning. It's integrating these ideas into life with a consistency. I'll give you another example, a fascinating story. There's a particular individual I know that's quite philanthropic. He got this proclivity, his feeling for philanthropy through his father. His father, also a philanthropist, wanted to instill this idea into his son, not only to give, but how to give. And he would make sure, as it was possible, that his son was present. When people with various needs would come to his parlor, to his business or to his home, and present their various needs, he made sure that his son was able to witness how you're supposed to deal, how you're supposed to treat people. Even though a person is asking for money, is really on the receiving end, he has to be treated with dignity and respect. And, you know, there's a passage in the Talmud, Bava Basra, that there are six blessings given to one who gives charity. But there are 11 blessings to one who treats with dignity, who lifts up the spirits of someone who's in need. So it isn't just a matter of giving, it's how you give. And when he was about to write out the check, he told his son to accept the signature to fill out the check. He wanted to make his son be trained that the idea of writing checks to people that are in need, sharing the gifts that God gives you with others, becomes part of him. He didn't lecture to his kid. He coached his child. This is all part of the coaching. But what coaching means is that you have to be an active parent. Perhaps it was easier in days gone by. Now, in the society we live, it's a particular challenge. Years ago, I guess the generation before mine, but years ago, there was no television. So you had to speak to your kids. You know, when they're nudging you too much, she says, what's on TV now? You know, then you flip through the TV guide. Oh, this is good for you. Why don't you go look at this, see this right now? We're relegating our role to television. I was visiting as a lecturer in a city in the East Coast, and I saw, it was very cute, I saw a flyer. And it read, says, would you give your child over to a babysitter that tells it over stories, horrid stories of violence and murder and the worst kinds of things, you know, what your babysitter is exposing your child to? Says, you never do such a thing. But this is what your television is doing. So we have a particular challenge in the society that we live in to still remain parents. We often think that our schools are substitutes for parenting. Unfortunately, the idea of morality is probably, to the extent that it existed in the last generation, I'm sure to a great degree it's already left this generation. It has to be, we can't preach to our kids because we're combining religion with the state. The school expects the parent to instill moral values. The parent expects the school to instill moral values. And the end comes out that the kid grows up to be a Vildachaya. Which reminds me of a great story. There's nothing to do with what I'm telling you, but it's a great story. Maybe you'll just remember this. I know the rabbi, and it's a true story, that he officiated a marriage, and he was about to write out the ksuba. It was the document, and he was writing in the Hebrew names. And he came into the name of the groom, and he asked the groom, what's his Hebrew name? And he says, I don't know. Do you remember? Says, did you have grandparents? Parents? He says, yeah, I had grandparents. Did they speak Hebrew, Yiddish? Yeah, yeah. He says, did they call you by a Hebrew name? No. He says, think, you know. I mean, he's in a spot over here, and the rabbi has to fill this out. Oh, yeah. I remember my mother used to call me Vildachaya. Another distinct challenge we have in our generation that didn't exist. Again, every generation has its unique challenge. That's not to say this is worse than any other generation, but there are unique challenges in every generation. And the challenge here is the challenge of two parents working. And very often, there's no other choice. I mean, they have, both parents just have to work. But it is a challenge. Because then ultimately, who's raising the child again? Because parenting is coaching. I mean, you have to... It's not just a matter of quality time, the 15 or 20 minutes or the day that you go out on that vacation, you spend time. It's as anyone is a music teacher. You can't just teach music once a month, you know, or teach baseball to a little kid once a month for a few hours. I mean, it's a constant coaching. When are you going to have the time? It's a challenge. But I just like to share with you the idea. And it's an idea that very often is really not contemplated. It's not thought over. There are so many hours a week that we put into our careers. So many hours a week we put into our children. I think it's worthwhile to sit down and make a calculation. How much career on one column, how much children on the other. And to see, is it possible to move some numbers from one column to the other column? Maybe it's not possible, but it should be a serious consideration. Finally, this morning I saw a fascinating comment in the Wall Street Journal. The author of this particular article described a phenomenon that he witnessed in Santa Rosa, California, but exists across the country. Mall owners who want to make sure that young teenagers, don't make a hangout of their mall and don't, you know, capture the public area, which will have a ill effect on the commerce of the, you know, of the mall itself. Pipe in music by Mozart. And those children flee. It really tells us something about our generation. I was raised on Mozart. And when it comes to our relationship with the popular culture, and the culture that we have is probably much closer to the pagan culture that our ancestors came in contact with thousands of years ago than to the culture of our immediate ancestors. One really has to have the courage, if one has decided that that the common culture is not the culture they feel comfortable with. They don't want their children hooked on heavy rock. They'd like their child to have more refinement and spirituality. One has to have the courage, I mean, and it's a courageous act, to be different and to raise your children a little differently. There's a fascinating story that I read dealing with Sigmund Freud. After Sigmund Freud started developing his theories, which was scandalous at his time, he faced tremendous difficulties. He lost his position teaching. He was really a pariah in the medical community. Only many years later did he achieve that status that he's known for today. His colleagues, his peers, are not heard of. Sigmund Freud is a household word. And they asked him, how did you have the courage to withstand, to go through all those difficult years? And he replied, you know, I'm Jewish. And when I went to university in Vienna, you know, I realized really how different I am. And I realized that I belong to the thinking minority, not to the gullible majority. That's Jewish chutzpah. However, it's that strength, directed, of course, in a different vein. But it's that strength that kept our ancestors, kept the Jewish people, on that road that has brought us here tonight. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, actually begins, it's the second paragraph, actually begins with the notion of, even though you are laughed at, you should have the courage of your convictions and not to cave under. Chutzpah comes in handy sometimes. Sparingly, but it comes in handy. And when it comes to raising children, it's important to use that chutzpah. And it's not something you keep in your pocket. You don't use it often. But when you need it, you should use it. So again, the C of children is coach. The H of children is human. Very often, we get carried away. And I think my parents had some sort of a dream that I would be this music prodigy. It was gefährlich. And they used to take me every week to these piano lessons. I used to sit in front of the piano. You have to know your child's limitations. And that's why the human... There's a great story. It's a true story. Yeah, sometimes when I say it's a great story, it may not be true. But this one is a true story. One of the great masters of Hasidus, Hasidic masters, was Reb Zusha of Anapol. Reb Zusha was a legendary figure. All kinds of stories are told of him. Perhaps the best is the one that occurred shortly before his death. And it was in his last minutes of life, and he was crying. And those around him, his disciples, his family, asked him, "What are you crying for?" He says, "In a few short moments, my soul is going to leave my body. And the process is going to begin that I'm going to eventually be judged. And if they asked me, 'Why weren't you Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu?' I said, 'Listen, I didn't have his gifts. I'm not a Moses.' If they asked me, 'Why weren't you the Baal Shem Tov?' I was the founder of the Hasidic movement. I said, I didn't have all that he was given. I have no fear of being asked that. But they're going to ask me, 'Why weren't you Zusha? Why weren't you all that you could have been?' I said, 'That's scary. That's what I'm crying about.'" The scale that we have to use for our children is something adapted for the child. He's not going to be somebody else's child. And he's not going to be the older brother. "Why didn't you turn out like that older brother that was so good? You know, or why can't you be nice like this one?" The person has to be themselves. It's interesting, and this is the first quote. Much research has been done over the last some 50, 60 years on developmental psychology. This was an area that was largely ignored by the founders of fathers of psychology. I'm sure you're familiar with the works of Jean Piaget in cognitive psychology, or Eric Erickson in emotional psychology. But the idea is children develop at a certain rate. Of course, every child is slightly different. But they develop in steps. And when you're holding on step C, you can't expect your child to be on step F or Z. It's like a plant that begins to grow and it's not big enough and you start schlepping it. It's like, "Why don't you grow? You know, why don't you?" It's not there. And we grow as we develop at a certain pace. And it's important for us to be sensitive that our child just may not be there yet. And in fact, they have on page 3, we quote the Gemara in Ksubas, Daf Nun 50a. The school system in the time of the Talmud was quite rigorous. Rav, one of the great teachers of the Talmud, told one of his disciples, Shmuel Bar Shilas, who was a teacher par excellence, he says, "Don't accept any child below the age of 6. This, of course, everything is relative. I just want to the basic principle. He's too young. He can't take it. It's too concentrated, the program. But once he reaches that critical age, says the language is sofale katura, stuff him like an ox. Says, basically, he's ready to study. Give him everything that he can take." And yet, and this, the Talmud develops a theme later on, if you see that the child is not responsive, he's just not ready yet. Until the age, in this particular context, until the age of 12. If he hasn't, by the age of 12, he hasn't listened, he hasn't developed, it's a do or die situation. Then you really have to lay down the law. But up until that point, you have to realize maybe it's not the child's fault. The assumption is of a normal child, so by the age of 12, there's no excuse. I mean, that's really the outer limit of his of that age. And at that point, one has to be a little tougher with the child. But there is a notion, and that's really what I want to bring out from here. There is a notion that you have to be sensitive to the limitations of your child. On one hand, we have these expectations And if he's able to, it's sofer l'ketur, we should stuff him like an ox. We should prod him. We should direct him. But if we don't see that our efforts are bearing fruit, it's perhaps best to just step back and wait. Perhaps now is not the time. I listened to a lecture. This was a lecture about children that had learning difficulties. And the teacher was trying, this is a group of parents and teachers, and the master teacher was trying to show, says, that very often, says, our techniques really don't work with a child who really has this block, so to speak. And he showed the class what eventually turned out to be a picture of a cow, the head of a cow. But it was very difficult to see. You just didn't see it. You know, it's one of those images that after you're shown, you say, aha, that's what it is. But as it was, the configuration, it was just very difficult. And these were educated people. There were many of them with graduate degrees, and they're looking at it, and they have no idea what this is. So he starts shouting at them. Selfish, nothing's happening. He takes out $50. He says, here's $50. Now tell. Nothing happens. And he says, you know what? Because if the person is not ready to see it, it's not going to help. So there has to be a sensitivity on the side of the teacher, or as we're dealing with this class, inside, in terms of the parent, to know your child's limitations. Which really means you really have to know your child. It isn't just hello, goodbye. It's really you have to spend time with your child. Because that's the only way you're going to know your child intimately enough to have that sense that he's not ready. Well, for this he's ready, and yet at this, he's not ready yet. I don't have to tell you that so much harm, psychological harm, has been done to children whose parents have these great expectations, gave these children such guilt that they didn't live up to their parents' expectations. And there's really no fault of the child. So the H is human. And I'd like just to end, you know, the last citation here is really something we're familiar with, is from the Haggadah. It's really, I quote from Mechilta, which is a midrash, which is really the one of the sources of the Haggadah. We speak about four sons. Each son is different. We shouldn't confuse it, and we don't give the answer to the wise son to the one who doesn't even know how to ask. And it really means that the parent has to be sensitive and has to know the child to see what those limitations are and what the correct answer should be. So on one hand, we start with the C is coach, but the H is human. You should see the foibles, the limitations of your child and be sensitive to them. The I of children is influence. Up until now, we've spoken with young children. You're coaching. This is the beginning years. Whatever you want your child to be molded into, you begin early. It's directed. It's one-on-one. You're a coach. The role, though, of a parent changes as the child grows. It's a different relationship. It's interesting, and this is the quote here I have on page 4 from the Talmud, from the Gemara and Kedushin, about perhaps how times have changed. Let me just quote this to a Rava said to Rav Nosson Bar Ami. Rava was one of the greats of the Talmud. whilst your hand is yet upon your son's neck, in other words, while you still have influence on your child. Says, and that's between, you know, 16 and 22. Says, then you should exert that influence. In other words, at least between those ages, he still thinks you know something. Others say between 18 and 24, it's probably not a hard and fast rule, and it probably changes with societies. But there's the idea, here we're dealing with young adults. And there's an age, at least, that they still think you know something. And at that point, it's a matter of talking. It's not coaching. But they're old enough and have the intelligence to assimilate your deepest views. It reminds me of the story of Mark Twain. And I don't know if I have this right, but it goes something like this, that at 16 years old, he was amazed how ignorant his father was. And by the time that he reached 21, he was astounded how much his father picked up in the last 5 years. So, it changes, you know. Sometimes I don't want to listen to you. But you have to be on top of your child. When he's reached the age of intellectual maturity, it's not a matter of just coaching him or rote training, but it's really to have a heart-to-heart talk. Because after all, says, you've assimilated much knowledge through your own studies, through your own parents. You should give it over to your children. So the I is influence. The other part of this, which just makes it really so difficult, perhaps when they're children, they don't pick up on this. But as they grow older, it's important that parents themselves have a consistency to their lives. In other words, if you want good children, it isn't just being good parents, you know, but being a good person. Because, I mean, after all, it says you can, again, if you can preach honesty, and you tell your child to be honest. But if they see dishonesty in your own life, you've killed it all. If you want children you want to be proud of, you have to be a person that your parents would be proud of. And if they're not proud yet, you know, you should work extra fast to make sure. The quote here on page 4, in the first, in the beginning of the page on paragraph B, deals with a period of time, the time of the judges, which was relatively a lawless period. Not necessarily lawless, but relative to other periods in Jewish history, it was a lawless period. And the Talmud attributes this lawlessness to the fact that the judges, the leadership, was not beyond reproach. The judge, if you could look at the quote, you said, if the judge would tell them your silver is dross, you're selling something to be pure silver, and it's not, and you're cheating your customer, he would retort, but you're cheating your own customers. I mean, the business that you have on your side is also, so that you're selling liquor mixed with water, and as you're selling something which you claim, you know, is other than what you're actually selling. The only way to effectively guide your child in the ideal that whatever you've decided is the ideal for your child. But you have to be that kind of a person yourself. You want nachas from your children, you have to be a person that your parents have nachas from. In other words, it's never too late. But you have to be that example. Maybe I'm getting a little far afield, but I just know from experience, from growing up. In many families, keeping Shabbos was very important. But unfortunately, due to many different circumstances, many parents made a decision, It's not a question of judgment about that decision, but whatever the situation was, they made a decision that they couldn't keep Shabbos. But they still demanded that their children keep Shabbos. I mean, it did not work very well. Maybe it worked in isolated situations. However, the fact is, it's very difficult to tell your child, do this, and your child goes back to you, but you don't do it. How can you expect me to do this? So, again, the I is, there's two parts to this. First, the one has to have the sensitivity to know when the child is receptive to your influence. And again, not just the coaching influence, but the deeper intellectual influence. And B, you yourself have to have that consistency in life. So your influence and what you'll tell your children will be effective. So that's the I. So you have C, coach, H, human, I, influence. L is love. And I want to put L and D together because they're really two parts, two sides of one coin. Here we have on page 4. I like to quote, this is the bottom paragraph first. It's a fascinating paragraph. Again, it's taken from the Gemara, the Talmud, and Kedushin. And here, Rabbi Meir, one of the great authors of the Talmud, the Mishnah, speaks about the Jewish people. But I'm just taking a parallel from this to our own lives. The Jews are called the children of God. And as he points out, they're speaking about the Jews who've fallen. They're called foolish sons, terrible sons. They have no faith. They're corrupt, but they're still sons. They're still children. The Torah is telling us, in terms of the Jewish people and God, how far we sink, we're still children. There's still a father there. And I think it has a parallel to us. A child should know that the parent is a parent, and there is a level of love there, no matter what the child has done. There's an undercurrent. The child should feel that security. Because one day, there's a good chance that child is going to come back. But there has to be a parent there to receive that child. Really, and that's what the passage in Kedushin is referring to God's relation with the Jewish people. The parent is still there. The relationships are strained. Maybe the child hasn't seen the parent in many years, but the parent's still there waiting to see the child. And it's important, no matter what happens, that the child senses Tati and Mommy, the parents, are still there. That's one side of the coin. In fact, now I want to go up to paragraph A, where we quote a Gemara in Soita, and Zayin Omad Aleph in 47a. In regards to one's, life is a balance. One's child, one's spouse. The right hand draws near. Right is always the symbol of the stronger hand. Love is always the strongest emotion. The child or the spouse should always feel it. There are situations, though, that we feel that they need a talking to. And there's a left hand. It isn't all right hand. It's a weaker hand, but there's a time that we push away, that we show, says, that we do love you. And that love is always going to be there. But the show of that love is going to be limited. And that's the left hand. And really this goes into, really this is the other side of the D of discipline. I saw recently quoted from the Gaon of Vilna in discussing of how to discipline your child. And I'm sure you all realize it's part of scripture. It's really part of tradition up until the relatively modern era that parents hit their children. And he says, the Vilna Gaon, that even though it's recommended, we're going to touch upon this, to sometimes severely discipline your child, but one should never do it while they're angry. It's for many reasons. First of all, chas v'shalom, you could hurt your child. Second of all, when they're angry, they'll also have a tantrum. And when they're angry at their brother or sister, they'll take it out on them, says, and hit them. Says, you should never, you have to always be, at least when it comes to discipline, you always have to be in control. If you can't control yourself, then just send him to his room. You cannot do anything more, because you're sending the child the wrong message, and who knows what you could do to the child. But when you do have your wits about you and you're in control, it seems clear from Scripture, from the Talmud, that sometimes and very often, depending on the child, a patch is in order. There has to be this sense the child feels there's an accountability. One of the great underlying themes of the culture that we live in is that we always excuse behavior. Somebody was a murderer. Well, he was beat as a child. What do you expect of him? And someone is a thief. Well, what can you expect of the person? I mean, he's deprived. He has an addiction. I mean, he just has to do this. And everyone just has to do this type of behavior or has to do that type of behavior. One of the basic themes of Judaism is that we have responsibility and accountability for our actions. And it says, there's a time of payment. There's a reward and there's a punishment. And if everything is... if everything is just the right hand, which is, of course, is the dominant hand, but if everything is just that right hand, again, what you're going to develop is a vilda chaya. I was recently reading an article and someone who was decrying this. He had seen from his window how some bully had beat up this smaller kid. And the mother of the bully, says, runs out to the kid and gives him a galeta from Ponim, you know, gives him a thing. Oh, you must be not be feeling well today. What's the message that the child gets? And it could be he doesn't feel well. But you don't beat somebody else's kid just because you don't feel well. And the child has to realize that there is an accountability. It also, and these the commentaries deal with, which is a which is something we're going to which really goes into the next area, the R of respect, is that there is an authority. You know, we have, especially America was created, this is the land of the free. You know, this is, don't tell me what to do. Mind your own business. Really, this is the... And there's a lot of positive things with this. I mean, that's why we were able to thrive in this country. But there is a downside of all this liberty. Because inherent, there's a certain lack, or it can lead to a certain lack of authority. I mean, a parent is a parent. And when a relationship is established, the parent is a is somebody who is an authority figure, and is early on established as such. The relationship allows for that authority figure to instill in this child those values that the parent feels is important. But if all the parent is a friend, well, that's his opinion. I got my opinion. And again, so we're discussing about every generation has its challenges. Our generation also has their challenges. And there is a greater tendency in the society that we live in today to deal with children as friends. Very often, this is there are many marriages that go sour. There are many single parent families. There are many parents that need friends. The way the society is structured today, very often we are in need of friends, and we make the mistake to think that our child will fill that need. A child is not a peer. I mean, it's a friend on one level, but it's a different kind of a level. You love your children, your children love you, but it's not a pal. Because you can't influence a pal, or at least it's limited. And that's why, says, there are two mitzvahs of the Torah regarding relationship with parents. One is kavedus avicha v'simecha, to honor your parents, which in practical terms, besides the honor and the you speak of your parents in great praise, there is the idea of you take care of your parent. You feed your parent. You give drink to your parent. There's unusual, at least traditionally, there's a special respect that you would give to your parent that probably you'd only find in the military, which they would give to a higher officer, or in the presidency or whatever, that someone would give, a low-level official would give the president of the United States. But in a Jewish home, traditionally, that place was taken by the parents. In fact, and really this is the quote that we have here on page 5, you see, that in a certain sense, a parent is a partner with God. See, in our respect, this is paragraph A. You can look at it yourself. This is taken from the Gemara and Kedushin. They are God's partners in your life, and they are treated akin to God. And that there's one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, that each one should have awe or reverence of his parents. This is part of Jewish law again, but there's the notion, which is required, that one does not contradict parents. At least openly contradict parents. You tell them you're all washed up. Even when they disagree, it's with a derech eretz. There's a certain respect, as if you'd be, as a lower officer would be, as a private would be disagreeing with a general. It's done in a certain way. You don't sit in a parent's seat. There's a certain awe, a reverence that's given to parents. It fosters that, really, a reverence for God. It fosters a reverence for authority and the idea that you're accountable to a higher authority. If after all, the person themselves, and this is very often what occurs in our society, is really the final arbiter. What do my parents know? What does anybody know? You got to think it through yourself and do it. It doesn't create an atmosphere that the parents could really instill too much into the children. The ancient model, really a model that was practiced for thousands of years amongst Jews up until the present, allowed for such a transference of values from generation to generation. So, there's That's the first part of this idea of respect. The idea that to instill in the child the idea that a parent is different. The parent. They should always, again, we have the L of the love. No matter what the child does, no matter what the parent does to the child in terms of disciplining, the child knows, should know, the parent loves the child. He should always have that security. But on the other hand, he realizes they're above him. They're parents. They're the generation removed. There's another part of parenting, of the respect. It's important to realize that fathers and mothers have differences. I'm not speaking about differences between them. I'm speaking about they have a different approach of parenting. I mean, that's part of the emotional makeup of the difference of men and women, of fathers and mothers. And there's a tendency, I mean, this is naturally how it is, that the mother is softer and the father, again, statistically, tends to be tougher, more rigid. That's what our natures are. But one thing one should keep in mind, really, and that's what I have the last quote here. It's on this, really, it's on the top of page 6. The Torah created a hypothetical case. And that's the case of what's known as the Ben Sorer or Mora, the rebellious son. A son under very limited circumstances that could be put to death after repeated stealing. And as the Talmud points out, it's something that would rarely, if ever, occur. And the purpose the Torah wrote this was more of its educational value rather than practical value. The educational value is that a child that begins life as a thief will end off life as a murderer. And one has to make sure early on the child is directed towards the proper way. There's another message here, though. And this is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Yeah, it says that the parents, again, this is for this is just another reason why it's only theoretical and never practical. The parents have to speak in the same voice. They have to sound alike, which is an impossibility. And he says it's an impossibility, and really the Torah only wrote this for its educational value. But the message being, you can't expect a child to totally listen to the parents and fault them for disobeying if the parents speak in different voices. They have to have a combined message. You can't run to the father for one thing if the mother says no, or to the mother says, or to the father if the mother says no. You know, we spend time, parents spend time, they go out, they talk. You know, there's planning that what goes into to dinner. You know, you plan where your vacation is, what you're going to do on your vacation. You have to sit down, the father, and plan strategy. Says, how are you going to deal with your children? Now, whatever you decide, it has to be consistent. They can't run from one to the other. And the parents have to have a policy that if the mother says no, you can't run to the father. You give the kid a punch. Your mother said no, it's no, or vice versa. There has to be this. It can't be undermined. They have to speak in one voice. This voice may be a little softer. This voice a little stronger. But as is humanly possible, there should be a single voice. They should come together, come together in a huddle, plan strategy. But the responses should be the same, and the vision that you have for the children should be one which is jointly decided upon. Because in that way you maximize at least what your influence on the child. Because if there's dissonance in the family, as you know yourself, you sit down and says, and you're listening to something and you're static, it's hard to listen. The Talmud has a statement, Trei Koli Loi Mishtami. It's hard to listen to two voices at once. So again, the R refers to respect. That there has to be an atmosphere cultivated in the home that the children respect their parents and really treat them godlike. The parents, in turn, though, have to have a united voice. Because there has to be, there can't be one parent saying one thing, the other parent saying something else. E is for education. Education deals many, many fields. As we quote the first quote here, page 6, quote again the Gemara in Kedushin, that a father is bound in terms of the requirement of circumcision, if it's a firstborn child, redemption, to teach the child Torah, to make sure he gets married, make sure he has a trade, has a livelihood. These are all responsibilities a parent has to a child. What's important to realize is what are the priorities that we have for our children. And really this is what we began in the introduction. A child has to have a livelihood. A child has to learn Torah. What has to be sacrificed? Ideally, well, again, which is a very difficult mitzvah to fulfill, but ideally, every Jewish child should grow up to be very well versed in the Torah. On the other hand, every child should have the means of having a livelihood. I'd like to share with you, this is really something my daughter gave me. On the first day of the new school year, all the teachers in one private school received the following note from their principal. Dear teacher, I am a survivor of a concentration camp. My eyes saw what no man should witness. Gas chambers built by learned engineers. Children poisoned by educated physicians. Infants killed by trained nurses. Women and babies shot and burned by high school and college graduates. So, I am suspicious of education. My request is, help your students become human. Your efforts must never produce learned monsters, skilled psychopaths, educated Eichmanns. Reading, writing, arithmetic are important. Only they serve to make our children more humane. It's important, again, in the scheme of things, to realize that our spirituality and humanity are the foundation that the other important things of life are built, and not vice versa. And when it comes to choosing a school, which is probably one of the greatest decisions you can make as a parent, it's important to make sure that the school that you choose is a school that fosters a spiritual and humane values. You know, it reminds me of the story that the husband and wife had been married for some 60 years, marital bliss, and they asked the husband, what's the secret of success? And he said, early on, we decided that there's going to be a division of responsibilities. All the important decisions I'll make, and all the minor decisions my wife will make. This was some years ago, so it may sound dated. They asked the man, so what are the major decisions? Well, how to end the Cold War, how to bring peace to the Mideast. And what are the minor decisions? Well, what school to send my kids to, et cetera, et cetera. From the Jewish point of view, where to send your child is a very important decision. And it's not just a question of how much they'll study, which is very important, but perhaps even more so of what kind of values are being fostered in that school. And if you're not happy with the school, and you have no choice, perhaps it's worthwhile to have a meeting amongst the parents, or even amongst the principal and the teachers. It says how to instill those humane values, those spiritual and moral values, that you feel that you yourself on your own just can't do without the help of the school. So the E here is for education. We've added here, if you've noticed, two other parts besides schooling. One is in terms of lifestyle. The Talmud encourages having a modest lifestyle. By virtue of having the historical view and realizing that wealth doesn't always last forever. And really the important thing is really the long haul. If you teach your children, the most important thing in life is satisfying physical desires. And you satisfy those desires. You give them the best of this and the best of that. You may not be doing your child a great service, because there's no guarantee that the child will always have the wherewithal to satisfy those desires. And sometimes, not only will he become, it's not just a question of he'll feel frustrated, but he may feel forced to take what we call unethical measures to make a living to satisfy those desires. And the type of lifestyle that you've given him may be just as addictive in a psychological sense. Than perhaps that the drugs that the child in the inner city, or unfortunately in the suburbs, feels the necessity to has the craving to always to have. In terms of education, again, this is kind of having nachas from children. It's very important to instill in your child, even though you give them all the love, but to instill something that really these things are not that important. Because you've given him something for life. That's part of teaching him a livelihood. It's survival. Because if a child is, if he has something good, it's wonderful. And if it's not so good, it's good. He'll live. The important thing is that he has food on his table. He's not so picky. And you've really taught him something he can live through life. Because there's no guarantees. The last part of the education, which I think is very important, has perhaps been overemphasized to a certain degree, is the idea of self-esteem. This is something we're going to discuss with at length in a future lecture. But in terms of dealing with children, the Talmud takes the view, and this is the quote, says, every single person is obliged to say, "Bishvili nivra ha'olam." This is in paragraph C on page 6. The world was created for my sake. Very often we have a false sense of humility. Well, I'm just a little person. I'm only so tall, so wide. I've been the hagomish, like I'm a nobody, a nothing. That's not the Jewish view. Every single one of us is extremely important. So important that it would have been worthwhile that the whole world was created just for any one of us. Our potential is tremendous. Our responsibilities are immense. But a child should have that sense of importance. Not that the world goes around him and everyone has to bow down to him. But it's the importance that he was given tremendous gifts. Has tremendous responsibility and tremendous potential. And this has to be cultivated in the child. And again, this is all part of the coaching. Because if you feel good about yourself, you feel you're a person that's truly capable and worthy, you can do tremendous things. My wife was at a lecture and she told me the story the lecturer told over about a particular class. Was a difficult class. And the teacher was given, there were many children with learning disabilities, emotional problems, assorted group of problems. And that teacher wrought a virtual miracle in that class, turned the class over. They performed far beyond the expectations of the administration. At the end of the year, the principal called in the teacher and commended the teacher what a wonderful job she had done with the class. And the teacher said, well, it's really nothing. I mean, they were brilliant kids. I just brought it out in them. Says, you know, she opened up the roll book and she says, look, she says, Timmy Smith, 135. Look at their IQ, you know. Joyce Miller says 143. And she went down the list. A brilliant kid. I just brought it out in them. So the principal says, can I see that book? Handed the book over. IQ numbers, they're locker numbers. But the teacher who thought that those numbers were the IQ numbers and they're really locker numbers brought out things in those kids that were totally unexpected. One of the major problems we have is that we have a very poor sense of our worth, of our potential. And it's important for parents, along with all the very important things, the moral teachings, and the idea of responsibility, is this sense of greatness. And I would like to end off with N, the last letter. So we went through, just briefly, we went through the whole thing of C, of children as coach, H is human, I, influence, L, love, D, discipline, R, respect, E, education, and N is never ending. It's important for us to realize that we are part of a continuum. It didn't start from us. It goes back thousands of years to our ancestors that stood at the foot of Mount Sinai. And we don't know how many generations it will proceed into the future. But we're all part of a continuum. And how we're going to affect our children is not just going to affect one generation. Who knows how many countless generations it's going to affect. If we lift up our children, it's not just our children, it's our Einiklach and Ureinaklach, and it's our grandchildren, great-grandchildren. It's an investment for the future. Very often we don't know. I mean, we only have a limited amount of time and a limited amount of energy. And we don't know, where should we put all of this? Should we put it in ourselves and our kids, and we need a vacation, and we have to do this, and we have to do that? You should just keep in mind, an investment in your children is an investment that reaps dividends that for perhaps thousands of years. Thank you for attending. Now, if there are any questions... Yes.
Thank you. That was very helpful. I have one question, though, going back to the human element. You talked about the differences between disciplining a 6-year-old versus a 13-year-old boy. And you mentioned that various techniques don't work with a particular child, and we should step back and wait because it may not be his fault. Like, if you were to just elaborate
a little bit more on that, as far as just stepping back and not doing anything or how to get them from 6 to 12 in one piece. Without really trying. Let me just give you a parallel to this. The quote that I had was taken from the Talmud and Ksubas. About advice for education, you know, to stuff them, but not to go full throttle. You know, there's another conversation that these two scholars had in the Gemara. It's taken from the Gemara of Talmud Bava Basra in 21a, in Chafalaf Amud Aleph. Here, Rav tells Shmuel Bar Shilas the following advice. First of all, he says about hitting kids. You know, even when I went to school, they used to paddle kids. They stopped. But, they didn't paddle children then. It was too cruel. He said, you take a very light strap. You know, you've symbolically given the message without really hurting the child. But he says, in addition, he says, you'll have children in your class that will be avid learners, and there were kids that will space out. He said, don't throw out the kids that space out. Keep them in your class. Because eventually, he says, they may catch on. You know, and if not, the experience itself at least is better being in the classroom than who knows what will be out in the street. Sometimes the child has to be in a holding pattern. You don't want them to be out in the street. Of course, it could very often be the problem is the teacher's no. We're not thinking about the teacher's no good, and you know where there are other problems, or the child needs special help. Which thank God that there are programs which are initiated which can help the child. But all else being equal, there's no special programs. I mean, assuming the situation, and assuming the child is the discipline has been maintained in the class. You know that the child does not disrupt other children. And you don't have the option, which would be ideal, to take the child out and to put him in a special program to lift him up. And you don't have that option, assuming that. The fact is that the child is still in the classroom, and that at least the teacher does make the effort, you know, of trying to make the child feel he is part of the class. Again, assuming where the problem is, or that the child isn't ready yet. Again, this is that particular problem. Not that the problem is he'll never be ready, where he has to be addressed with special professionals. But assuming that he's not old enough, he should still feel part of it. You know, there's a quote in Pirkei Avos, an Ethics of the Fathers. That one should be, says, a zon of la royas. One should be the tail of lions rather than roish l'shulim, rather the heads of foxes. You may be the smallest of the class. I'm again assuming the child fits somewhere in the class. You know, it's not a behavior problem, and he's not. The other factors have been mitigated, but he's still part of the process, and perhaps. You know, one day, you know, as long as he's there and he's part of the process, there's some hope that one day he may mature. Or one day, as the classes go on, he may find that special teacher that will have a special liking to him, and there's a special chemistry that will turn on. But if the other option is, well, he can't be the best in the class anyway, you know, so might as well put him on a different track or to, you know, it may be a tremendous disservice to the child. The child has to feel at least he may even be the smallest member, but he's still part of the group. And he at least has that sense of identification, you know, of the group on a different level, on a different, you know, on a different note. We find this by mitzvahs. The Gemara makes the comment, the Gemara in Makkos and Hamad Beis in 5b, that says you have a group of people who are involved in mitzvahs. Right now we're having just as a parallel, that they're fundraising, this Sunday is going to be Super Sunday, you know, this is a fundraising thing that's going to affect the whole community in terms of the Jewish Federation. There are many different parallel organizations. And very often you're not a big giver. You know, you can't. For whatever reason, you're overcommitted for other things or for other limitations you have. Your time is limited. But by the fact is you put in something. You're part of the group. Even though you're not a major player of the group, there's a special reward which is given to you as being, you're considered as the group. You may be a small person there, but you're considered as really part of that. But you say mitzvahs, so those who are involved in mitzvahs, even in a minor role, but since there's an identification with the group, you're part of that group, Hashem's God treats you in a very special manner. The environment is extremely important, even though, you know, there's a there used to be a saying in Yiddish, in certain areas in Europe, other going, other gevir. Now, there's either you're going to be a tremendous, grow up to be a tremendous genius, great scholar, or this tremendously wealthy person, like nothing in the middle. But unfortunately, we don't, most people, if you look at a bell curve, most people are somewhere in the middle. I mean, that is the nature of things. So it's really not so much, very often, a life of that you are the head of the class, but you're in the class. We just went through Rosh Hashanah. I'll just end off with this thing. I'll share with you this thought. Many of the great rabbis have said, you know, it comes the days of Rosh Hashanah. It's very important to be part of a group of people that are doing mitzvahs, doing things, even though, again, you're a minor player in this. But you have a role. You count. Because when the judgment comes, part of the consideration of the judgment is, says, if you will be affected, how will it affect the group? In other words, if this person, whatever crime the person commits and is worthy of the death penalty, chas v'shalom, but if he goes, what's going to happen to the group? Like, there's a strength in numbers. And therefore, as being part, an integral part of an organization that does good things, even though you may not be the greatest donor or the greatest, you have the greatest managerial skills, but you do play a role, it really counts. Because how God treats you affects the group now. It's going to treat you a little differently. So it's very important, for many reasons, to consider yourself part of the group. And getting back to the child, in this holding pattern, even though he can't succeed, but he's part of the group. And maybe one day, as part of that, he'll naturally feel he has a place, he has confidence, and he'll rise. Okay.
One of the great frustrations of parenting is that even though as we listen to you tonight, and I suspect I'm not the only one who had this thought, often we find that we do something in a moment of unguardedness or anger or whatever, when a child does something suddenly unexpected and the person instinctively reacts and reacts the wrong way, instantly the parent will know that he had done the wrong thing or said the wrong thing to the child, but the damage has been done. And unfortunately, that often happens in raising children because the child suddenly does something unexpected and you're off guard. And even though the lessons that you have taught today, we can be in total agreement with them, in that moment you had the wrong reaction and you've done damage. And the question is, what do you do then? How do you follow up something like that? Because I suspect it happens with the best of us.
Okay. I can only tell you what I do here. The question was, what do you do when you yourself lose control? The damage is done. You called your kid your idiot. You beat him to a pulp. Whatever you've done, and then afterwards you have regrets. What do you do? Again, I can tell you only what I do. Sometimes. You have to speak to your child. You have to speak to the child to tell them, what you did is terrible. But I overreacted. And I'm sorry. I really shouldn't have done this to you. And you should apologize. You still did it wrong, and I would have done it to you like this and like this and like that, and you still deserve to be punished. But I just, I'm human. I make mistakes too. I'm very sorry. However, it doesn't excuse you. And I don't want you to ever do it again.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.